And subsequently, in discussions with legislative council, the chair finds there are some issues that I would like to resolve before we send this on to the floor for a vote. It is always my preference that that everything is clean before it goes out of committee. And, you know, given that, it is necessary, or I feel it's necessary, to bring it back to committee and try to address those issues. And as a consequence, I would need a motion to suspend the rules for possible reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2788.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee.
I move that the rules be suspended for purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2788.
Representative Lee moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 2788. Is there any discussion? The body will note that we do need a two-thirds vote on this, and so the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Wirtz?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative
Smith?
Aye.
Representative
Cormier?
Aye.
Representative King?
Aye.
Representative
Leonard?
Excuse.
Aye.
Chair Johnson?
Aye. Okay, at this point, the motion carries and the rules have been suspended, and we now need a motion to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2788 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2788 was sent to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Lee moves that we consider reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2788 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Those of the opinion then, with seeing no discussion or hearing no discussion, those of the opinion that we should reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2788 was sent to the floor with a due pass amended recommendation will vote aye. Those no, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative
Smith? Aye.
Representative
King?
Aye.
Representative
Cormier?
Aye.
Representative
Leonard?
Excuse.
Representative
Lee? Aye. The motion carries, and we now have House Bill 2788 back in our possession in the committee. We will, for the purposes of the committee's information and the audience's and concerned citizens' information on this, it will be our intention to hear the discussion and, if appropriate, do a work session on Wednesday of next week. Okay. Okay. At this point, we have Representative Merkley here for invited testimony on the House Bill 3854. Will inform us on what the bill was.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3854 received testimony last week. This is the bill that imposes a surcharge on the registration of boats using a two-stroke boat engine. It's requiring the State Marine Board to develop educational programs on environmental consequences of operating the two-stroke carbureted boat engines. We do have, which I received this morning, the Dash 1 amendment, and I am hopeful that Representative Merkley will explain what the amendments do.
For the this information, this work session, it's invited testimony only. So since I have invited the three gentlemen that are at the table now, since they came up, apparently I've invited them. We will proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Merkley. Mr. Chair and members of the committee,
The Dash One Amendment is in front of you. This undertakes to fulfill the goal and vision that was laid out before you last week, and we have come as a group, and behind me, DEQ is represented, Skipper's Clean Oregon Waters, and OEC, Oregon Environmental Council, as well as the Steelheaders and the Marine Board. And it was our task to try to find a collective way, a way that we could reach consensus on, to address the question of trying to motivate the folks who are using engines that are carbureted two-strokes to consider replacing them with new fuel-efficient engines that also, along with the fuel efficiency, pollute a tremendous amount less. So this becomes a win-win for the state. We obtain clean waters. We move decrease a stream of dangerous chemicals. And for the boaters, we provide an opportunity to obtain a new engine at a discount. And the way that we forged this compromise, you might recall the original bill proposed a fairly complicated arrangement whereby we would place a fee on carbureted two-strokes and then use those funds to fund a rebate program. And it was pointed out in the initial hearing that that caused a lot of problems. It caused a lot of problems because the database would have to be changed, because we would have to figure out how to deal with people who use several different engines on the same boat. We'd have to deal with the situation where engines would be exchanged during the course of a year. And it is a completely different arrangement from the current structure, where our registration fee is based on the length of a boat. And also, we would have to educate people as to what type of engine they have, because many people have no idea if they have a carbureted two-stroke or a fuel-injected two-stroke. So what we have come back with is an increase in the registration fee rather than a fee specifically on carbureted two-strokes. This spreads the costs out over a larger number of both power boats and non-powered boats that are over 12 feet in length. Basically, your river users, it also raises money not just for the rebate program, but also for the many of the neglected and postponed projects that the people using the river have wanted to undertake in terms of docks and facilities and enforcement that haven't been able to make it to the cutoff point. So what we now have is a simple system. You will remember we had a very large fiscal implementing the first strategy. This strategy basically has the same level of overhead as what we do now, because it's just changing the fee level and using all the current systems. And that is pretty much what we have before you. This isn't, we have a couple of wrinkles. We got this back a couple hours ago, and everyone's read through it, and there were a couple of drafting problems. But I think that we're all on board in terms of the philosophy, and we agree that a few words need to be changed, and at the will of the chair, any of the three of us sitting here or three of us sitting behind me would be happy to speak to the compromise that has been forged.
Okay. Well, let me start out then. Phil, if you have any comments that
thank you, Mr.
Like.
Chair. Appreciate the opportunity. We're pleased to have been involved with the work group that was convened by Representative Merkley. I was there on behalf of the Northwest Port Fishing Industry Association and Northwest Steelheaders. And we had some disagreements about the original bill, but our disagreements centered around what was the best course of action to reduce pollutants in our waterways and in our air, not the need to reduce those pollutants. We feel that the industry has moved forward aggressively in the mid-90s under the EPA 2006 standards, but we also see this bill, as amended, to be another aggressive step here in the state of Oregon towards removing carbureted two-stroke outboards off the waters of Oregon. But there's also, with the bill now, we're addressing another issue, and that is the great need for access to our waterways, for facilities for our waterways, for law enforcement on our waterways. And this is consistent with our position that we've represented here in the legislature for a long time. So there's obviously the added benefit of the amended version has a much much less administrative cost and gets these dollars out there on the waterways where they're needed. So with that, I will close and be available for any questions that you might have.
Long story short, you're supportive of the amendments?
That's correct, sir.
And the bill as amended?
The bill as amended.
Paul?
Chairman, members, I'm Paul Don Heffner, Director of the Marine Board. We also had serious concerns with the original bill introduced because of the engine tax aspect of it. It did impose significant workload and had a high fiscal because of the workload impact of identifying and tracking all those different engines and types. In addition, the original bill drew a fairly heavy opposition from marine dealers, the National Marine Manufacturers Association, and others. Working with the working group, we've been able to address those concerns, and now I'm pleased to report to you that the marine manufacturers, I mean marine dealers, and our agency are on board with supporting the bill in with the amendments. It does reduce the overhead cost, because basically there's none with collecting the additional fees. It does have a broader range of benefits in addition to providing incentives to remove two strokes from service and enhance air and water quality, which we certainly support. It does have a broader array of benefits to all boaters in the sense of additional access facilities and much needed law enforcement services. So it has a little something in it now for everybody in terms of support. It's a much more positive approach than the engine tax that was originally proposed. There are one or two technical changes that need to be made to the Dash 1 amendments dealing with the accounting and some of the percentages in there, but we can iron those out without much difficulty. Fundamentally, we are in support with the concepts within the bill with setting up a framework for the rebate program working with it. I think I can speak fairly that the marine dealers are enthusiastic about the prospects of partnering with us on this program and also leveraging the marine industry, the manufacturers, to extend the benefit of these rebates by doing multiple rebates, one from the manufacturer, one from the Marine Board to grow them larger. So we would indicate our support for the bill. I would note in terms of the fees, fee increases are never popular, but Oregon is on the threshold of the need for a fee increase. We discussed this with Ways and Means this session as a part of our budget. In fact, they reported out a budget note to us telling us to take a very hard look at a fee increase. So we're on the cusp of needing to do that with or without this bill. The terms of fees, for your information, Oregon has among the lowest fees of the western states and our neighboring states when you consider registration fees, excise taxes, personal property taxes, and sales taxes that are imposed on boat ownership in our neighboring states. Oregon is the lowest of our neighbors with Washington, Idaho, California, Nevada. With the increases under this bill, we would be much more comparable to those other states. And another way of looking at it in terms of toys, which is what most of these boats are, the comparable fee for a similarly priced and similarly sized recreational vehicle in Oregon or travel trailer is usually three times the fee, the current fee that's charged for boats. So I think in comparison to other toys in Oregon and other toys in the western states, our fees are modest to say the least. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Paul, is there a fiscal impact? I was confused about that.
We have not, Mr. Chairman, Representative May, we have not prepared a revised fiscal impact to it. However, there would be no additional administrative overhead with fee collection, which was the big part of the original fiscal impact. There were a number of staff positions, data processing costs, and other things that will not occur with this scenario in the amendment. All of the revenue that's generated under this bill will be available for distribution through the rebate program for law enforcement and voting access facilities. So 100% of the benefits from this bill will be returned to users.
Great. Representative, I'm looking through this quickly. In the previous bill, there was a sunset date of 2006, as I recall. Is that still in this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei. The sunset was actually motivated or structured in the original bill by the point we get to when we get to a point that only 5% of the engines are two-stroke carbureted engines that are in use in the state. That's the same sunset we've kept in this revised amendment. Now, 2006, and the reason you may be thinking about 2006 is that is the date that the federal ban on the sale of new two-strokes goes into effect.
Great. Good. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The original bill had a dollar figure in the rebate, and this is a sliding scale. Are we assuming same ballpark?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cruz, there's a slightly different strategy here in that the Marine Board is given full responsibility to set the rebates instead of us setting it out by statute. However, also in the structure is a self-balancing scheme. That is, if the amount of money that is set aside for rebates is not used in a particular year or a particular six-month period, the Marine Board can say, we're trying to find where supply meets demand, and now we can offer a higher rebate because we have more funds and we have a better sense of the pattern. If, on the other hand, the response exceeds expectations and the money is depleted for rebates, Green Board is able to say it's clear that given our revenue flow, we need to decrease the rebates by a certain amount. And the language in the bill as amended is that the Marine Board will seek to balance the incoming money for rebates and the outgoing money for rebates in a given year.
I guess, you know, even if you double what was in the original bill and say it's a $500 rebate on a $8,000 to $10,000 engine, the incentive's really not there. We're trying to solve a problem that we assume exists. I can understand why the industry is excited about this because we've shifted the burden to boat owners, and so this is a tax on boat owners.
Other questions?
I guess I would have one question too, and going a little bit about, you know, my constituent who, as I understood, you said that everybody was going to kind of be happy with this and treat it equally and fairly and that sort of thing. Do I get the gist of it correctly? And I'm thinking about everybody's going to get this sort of thing, but my constituent who's spent $12,000 to upgrade his engine, his two-cycle to a four-cycle last summer, and he's going to pay the same increased fee that the guy who is going to get the rebate is going to get. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct under the structure of the bill. It's our anticipation in the timeline of this, it's very likely that particular constituent, if they're using if they are a frequent user of their engine, is likely to be replacing it down the road while these rebates are still there. So there's a good chance that they will be able to utilize the program. But indeed, I can't say that with any fee structure there will be individuals who benefit more than others and use waterways more than others, but we'll all benefit by this cleanup of the water.
And Mr. Chair, I would add that they would also receive the additional benefit of increased motorized boat facilities for the increase in the fee. So it's not simply a matter of the rebate program that's being funded, but it's also the increased need for law enforcement, increased need for facilities, which the Oregon Marine Board is well documented.
But Jeff's constituent, excuse me, who is going to do this summer after this bill goes in effect, gets the benefit of a rebate. My constituent doesn't, because he did it last summer.
That would be true.
That would be true. Okay, I just want to know that that's true, so that when we talk about fairness and equality, we, you know, we know what our definitions are.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
One more. It was said it was a win-win. Well, there's obviously a lose in here, and that's for boat owners, but I guess I have never felt that the fact that we have a fee that's lower than the fee in Washington is a defensible reason to raise the fee.
Okay, I think that was a comment, not a question.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think the obligation that this group has, that Jeff, is to bring us back the clean language on the bill before we can, you know, really proceed with anything else. I certainly would be happy to entertain any other questions.
Mr. Chair, if they're going to come back, I would like to see some statistics as to how much pollution two strokes put in the river.
I think we have that. And,
do we have that?
We have it.
What is it?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'll be happy to provide the additional information to Representative Cruz as well. I'll also provide each member of the committee with a copy of a chapter of a book that really addresses the science of the problem of two-stroke output in the water. There's crude assumptions, and I think crude is the right word because you can't measure every boat in the water, but roughly a quarter to a third of the hydrocarbons that go into the tank on a carbureted two-stroke come out of the exhaust pipe. Roughly 60 to 65% of the hydrocarbons that come out of the exhaust pipe go into the air, and roughly 35 to 40% of them stay in the water. Those accumulate primarily in the micro layer of the water and then later in the sludge at the bottom. And I will provide an article discussing these issues. But if you take a crude estimate of 100,000 engines, and I think we have about 120,000 in active use, and make certain assumptions about the number of days in which the boats are in use, it's very clear that you can get a ballpark figure of about the equivalent of 3 million gallons of hydrocarbons coming out the exhaust pipe, which would be crudely 1.2 million gallons that stay in the water. And even if that's off by a significant factor, a factor of two, when you think about the damage that an 8,000-gallon oil spill can do, it's a significant level, and I'll provide additional copies to all the committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How long will this take us? How long will your fixes take us?
I think we can have them Monday unless the drafter is under an emergency.
Thank you very much. At this point, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3854. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3971. And I believe this is Representative Lee's. Would you like to tell us what the bill's about and what it's for and any other pertinent information before we start the public testimony from the audience?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3971 provides two tools for water users to use to deal with water shortages either created by drought or in using innovative approaches to deal with the Endangered Species Act. The first part of it deals with drought management, and it mirrors Senate Bill 644 that was passed out of the committee on the other side. The second portion of it deals with evaluation of water rights, which is basically a utility statute that we would like to remove or relocate in the proper place. The reason that we need both pieces of language, although Senate Bill 644 is coming out of the other committee, is because it was drafted with both pieces to fit into the relating clause. So with that, I think we're ready to proceed. Okay, we'll open the hearing on House Bill 3971, and the first witness is Scott Ashton from the Oregon Association of Nurserymen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Scott Ashkin, representing the Oregon Association of Nurserymen. We were the requester of the legislation, and I want to thank Representative Lee for allowing us to put our drought relief legislation into one of our priority bills, which you have before you as House Bill 3971. The legislation which we passed to be introduced, and perhaps it would help if we looked at the printed bill for a moment here to kind of understand the confusing peregrinations of the amendments that you have before you. We had initially asked for three pieces of legislation, three changes to the drought statutes, and then upon consideration, we supported an amendment to delete one of those three provisions from the bill. The amendments that we asked for are identical to your 3971-3 amendments, with one exception, which I will allude to in a moment. Going back to the printed form of the bill, if you look at the language in Section 2 and Section 3 of the printed form of the bill, that language refers to a condition which the printed form of the bill refers to as a moderate drought. Now, without boring you with describing that, we support the Dash 3 amendments because they eliminate all of that proposed new language dealing with moderate drought. So hopefully we don't have to discuss that. That's the first thing that the Dash 3 amendments do. They take out anything that refer to a moderate drought. That then leaves what we believe to be almost a clean bill, which deals then just with two items. One, allowing an expedited approval by the Water Resources Commission and Department of an application for a transfer under emergency drought conditions following upon the governor's declaration of an emergency drought. The provision would allow an expedited approval by the Department of Transfer between a primary water right and a supplemental groundwater right. It's a small tool to add to our tool chest to help transfer existing water rights during a time of drought to help water users. And the second provision that remains in the bill in the Dash 3 amendment allows all water right holders, not just government agencies, as the law reads now, the emergency drought statute, but allows all water right holders to apply for and get approval of lease options. So that's really during the period of the emergency drought declaration by the governor. That then is really all the bill does, with the exception of the language which you see on the on page 2 of the Dash 3 amendments on line 26. And line 26 of page 2 of the Dash 3 amendments repeal an old statute, I believe it dates from the early 1920s, that limits the value of a water right to, if I read the statute correctly, just the value of the waterworks and the construction of the waterworks by which the water is delivered to the user. I'll conclude my comments by saying that we have Senate Bill 644, which is a clean bill, hopefully coming out of the Senate. We passed it out of committee a few days ago, which is the Dash-3 amendment without the repeal of the valuation statute. And the only difference between the Dash-3 amendments that you have before you to House Bill 3971 and 644 is just the existence of that that repeal of the valuation statutes found on page 2 of the Dash-3 amendment. With that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'll conclude my comments, and I am available for questions if you'd like. I do wish to say that with regard to 3971, the Oregon Association of Nurserymen supports the drought relief provisions of the bill. We have no position with regard to the repeal of the valuation statutes, and we understand that that may be problematic. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. questions? Thank you. At this point, we have Rick Glick with Davis, Wright, and Tremaine. Is that correct?
Okay. Chair Jensen, members of the committee.
When I looked at the sign-up sheet, I thought I had the whole firm here, and I'm getting worried.
Well, almost.
Almost, okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Glick of Davis, Wright, Tremaine, a law firm in Portland. And I'm here today representing the city of Lincoln City with regard to the valuation provision of the House Bill 3971-3. We urge adoption of the amendment that would repeal 537.390. I have written testimony that I'll leave with your administrator to support this, but very briefly I'd like to go through the main points that we have here. First, the statute we're talking about, ORS 537.390, what it does is it says for rate-making purposes and for proceedings for the acquisition of water rights, that the value of the water rights would be limited to the actual cost of developing the waterworks themselves, the construction project itself, and no intrinsic value to the water. We've taken a look to try to find out what the origin of that statute was, because it has never been cited in an Oregon appellate court, and to my knowledge had not been invoked. After practicing water law in this state for 22 years, I've never seen it used for any purpose. But it was enacted in 1927. There is no legislative history that's available to show what it's for, but in looking at it, it appears to me that what the concern is when they say for rate-making purposes, the idea is that the consumer would be protected from loading into rate base for rate-making purposes an inflated value of the water right, which would not happen for water utility customers or the utilities owned by the public, like a municipal water supply. So it was a rate equity measure. In my testimony that I submit today, I have an erroneous statement in that I say that there are very, very few private water utilities for which this is appropriate to, and that the commission, Public Utility Commission, doesn't have much to do with water utilities. I've been informed just before this hearing that is not the case, but I think it is still true that the vast majority of Oregonians receive their water from publicly owned water utilities, which is different than it was in 1927. The reference to proceeding in the statute, we think, refers to a condemnation proceeding in which a municipality or some other government agency would be acquiring the water rights. And again, the issue is that the public not be required to pay too much for the resource. It's interesting to note that in that statute in 1927, the water rights themselves were limited to 50-year periods, and after which the municipalities, local governments, or the state could acquire the water right just by paying fair market value. That's not our law today. Water rights are issued generally in perpetuity so long as the water's put to beneficial use. So it occurs to us that the statute had an origin, 1927, out of concern for protecting the public against a risk that really isn't very large today, and as I say, has never been invoked. So why do we care about this? We care about this because we think it has a chilling effect on water marketing, on the transfer of water between willing buyers and sellers, which we think is going to become increasingly important in this state as it has in other Western states, as water supplies get more and more scarce and as the importance of endangered species limitations make it much more difficult to acquire new water rights. You have to be efficient with the water that you have allocated and provide a means to trade it back and forth in a way that the seller can receive enough gain from doing the deal that they have an interest in doing it. Lincoln City is in that position right now where it is trying to acquire water rights from a neighboring water district, and the value of the water is very important to the success of the sale. If that value were limited, as suggested in 537.390, we don't think it's likely that it would, but it's possible that it could. If that were to happen, we don't think that we can make this transaction and we could have this water sale, which would force Lincoln City to develop its own water supply at a much greater cost and much more burden to the environment. So for those reasons, we would ask that the measure be repealed. I'd just like to say that in chatting with the Public Utility Commission and our representatives here today, they are concerned that, in fact, they do need this authority in their statute to protect ratepayers. We would be more than happy to work with the Commission and with your staff to adopt an amendment that would remove this provision from the water rights statutes, which it seems to apply to, put it in the Public Utility Commission statute and limit it to rate-making purposes for the commission itself. That would work for our purposes, and I think would protect the interests they are concerned about, too. And with that, I will stop and answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Actually, I was aware, Rick, from other discussions that people thought that this was actually related more to electrical utilities using water power. And when we changed the hydroelectric rules to not allow the state to take the water right after 50 years, there seemed to be some parallels there. So I, too, did not realize that the PUC actually was still using it today for completely separate purpose for drinking water districts, supposedly.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Right, we have Martha Pagel with Robin Williamson and Wyatt. Is that right? Good afternoon, Martha.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martha Pagel. I'm an attorney with Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt, a law firm in Portland. And I'm here today representing a small water district on the coast, the Kernville, Glen Eden Beach, Lincoln Beach Water District. And we're here in support of the provision of the amendments that you have that deals with that valuation statute that Rick Flick just testified to. And we did originally intend to appear here today in support of repeal of the statute for the reasons that Mr. Glick laid out for you, that the statute where it is located in the Water Resources Department in the chapter dealing with water rights and issuance of water rights kind of hangs as a cloud over transactions that involve transfers of water rights. And since Oregon law was, since Oregon's first water code was enacted nearly 100 years ago, we have had in our provisions the ability for a water right holder to transfer the water right to another party. It's called a transfer. It's been in our statutes for years. And the limitation on transfers is that the exchange, the change, not result in injury to other water rights. But to my knowledge, from my years of experience at the Water Resources Department and as with the state for more than 17 years, I was never aware until today that this statute ever had any applicability As from the Water Resources Department's perspective, it was a kind of one of those statutes that hung out there. Nobody really knew why it came into being in the first place or how it was intended to be used, and it certainly was never applied in my experience, and I'm not aware of anyone at the department who can recall when it was ever applied. We learned today from the conversations with the folks from PUC that it does have some significance to them, and we certainly understand their concern in wanting to maintain provisions that relate to their business. So I guess I would echo what you've heard from Mr. Glick, that it seems like there would be an opportunity to work on figuring out a way to either move this, to move the statute to those that pertain to the PUC, and to clarify that it is not intended to affect the transfers of water rights between holders of water rights where rate making is not involved. And from the standpoint of the water district that I represent, they are interested in being able to move water to help more effectively serve coastal communities, do that in a way that is efficient, that takes advantage of water rights that have already been established. The transfer process is the mechanism to do that, but they need to be able to do that without the cloud of this valuation limitation. Be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Kurtz, thank you. I know you're not with Water Resources anymore, Martha, but to me you always will be. Is there a definition somewhere of a severe drought anywhere, or I'm trying to figure out in this bill what triggers this action, and it's severe continuing drought, and which I'm assuming is a subject to interpretation. I know Tom could maybe better answer this, but with your experience, I thought you might know if you have had a standard that you've used before for something like that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, speaking not for the department, but from my experience with the department, as I recall, there is not a statutory definition of severe and continuing drought, nor in the rules particularly, but there is a process by which the state drought council monitors conditions, snowpack, surface water indicators, and makes a recommendation to the governor. There would be a declaration made by the governor. It happens at the request of a local government. A county government requests the declaration of severe and continuing drought, and that's made on the recommendation of the drought council.
So it'd be similar, Mr. Chair. It'd be similar to any other disaster declaration sort of thing from the executive branch.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz. It's a kind of an interesting twofold consequence. Under state law, the declaration of the drought emergency triggers these provisions that are in ORS Chapter 536. They deal with water rights and use of water, and it's basically authority of the Water Resources Commission and Department. But there's also a federal declaration, and there's federal, usually it's financial assistance that can be made available after the governor declares an emergency. So under state law, there are certain tools that are triggered, but the declaration also then makes farmers, for example, in a Klamath Basin where the drought emergency has already been declared, some of those folks may be able to apply for federal assistance. If I may, I'd like to clarify for the record that my client that I'm representing, the water district, doesn't really have any position on the drought-related aspects of this measure, but I'm happy to provide any background that you like.
Questions for Martha? Martha, at some point I was not listening in your conversation. Did you speak about the repeal of 537-390?
Mr. Chair, that was my purpose in being here is to address that valuation statute and the proposed repeal. That's what is of concern.
You are supporting that
we are supporting that repeal. Although given the concerns expressed by PUC, you'll hear from them directly, we would certainly be open to some other approach short of an outright repeal.
Martha, in relationship to water rights, It is my understanding that those, if they are free, that the water is free.
Mr. Chair, it's correct that the person who holds a water right doesn't pay any money to the state for the use of the water.
It would seem, therefore, only reasonable to me
since it's free to the user, that the user not be able to collect any blue sky on something that's free. Is that a really wild off the cuff assumption?
Mr. Chair, it's certainly one that's held by a number of people who are involved in discussions about water rights and water marketing. Some of the perspective that I would offer on that debate is that the water users have invested a lot of capital in developing the water use, putting the water to beneficial use, and have acquired a property interest in that water right, having gone through all of the steps to perfect their water right and obtain a final certificate. And in Oregon, we do recognize a type of property right that's associated with your final vested water right, your final certificated water right. And given that, there's some concern whether the state should be involved in limiting the value that a person can get when they choose to transfer that water right to someone else. The statutes clearly do allow that transfer to take place, and in the water rights law, the only limitation is that it not injure another water user. So we have a history of allowing these kinds of transactions. To my knowledge, the state has never been involved in trying to affect the value that changes hands between private parties, setting aside this rate-making issue.
Well, I can certainly see that the possibility of the wording of the statute that you're allowed to only recover the actual cost of perfecting those water rights, that actual cost may have inflated, you know, if it were to have to be done today, and that therefore that may be some, there may be some inequity there. But I guess I have some concern about and see some potential for some creativity on people's part in terms of making money off of something that didn't cost them anything.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think it's important to keep in mind that if this valuation statute, 537-390, were now interpreted, applied, or actually amended so that it did affect the exchange of money between, say, Farmer A and Farmer B in accomplishing a transfer of their water right, that would be a dramatic change in the way Oregon water rights and water law have been carried out over the years. Those kinds of transactions happen all the time. The Water Resources Department doesn't ask how much money, if any, has changed hands and has never gotten involved in that, to my knowledge and in my experience. And I'm aware of those kinds of transactions happening all over the state for many, many years. So I think if this valuation statute were applied in that way, kind of a very literal application of it, that would be a change in the practice and policy that people have understood to be Oregon law on water rights.
Okay. Questions? Thank you. Tom Byler, Water Resource Department. It's good to see you again. Yes, Tom.
Good afternoon, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. For the record, Tom Byler with the Water Resources Department. I'll keep my testimony fairly brief because you've had a pretty good discussion about the key issues in this bill. I want to focus on two areas, and I'll keep my comments to the Dash 3 amendments. In regard to sections 1 and 2, both of those sections of the Dash 3 amendments relate to the emergency drought provisions in statute. As was mentioned in earlier testimony, these provisions are identical to a bill that passed out of the Senate committee, I believe earlier this week, Senate Bill 644, and we were supportive of that bill and would be supportive of these provisions as well since they are identical. The Section 3, the repeal of the valuation statute, we're neutral on that position for some of the reasons that are describing that the department really doesn't use this particular statute. Our counsel suggested she's not even sure that we have any enforcement authority over it. In terms of private transactions between water right holders, again, as Martha Pagel mentioned, department does not get involved in terms of the the final price or value that those private entities agree to in terms of that transaction. Our concern is for the transfer of that water right and to make sure that in making that transfer, that no other water rights are injured as a result of that transfer. So we don't get involved in the valuation on these particular transactions, but just to make sure that when that transaction occurs, that it doesn't adversely affect any other water right holder. With that in mind, I guess, we don't really have a position. We're neutral on the valuation statute. We wouldn't affect our business one way or the other if it stayed or if it were repealed. And I'll certainly defer to the folks from the PUC in terms of their issues relating to that particular provision. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions for Tom? Thank you, Mr. Biden.
Thank you.
Kathy Miller from the PUC.
Hello, Mr. Chair, Representative. My name is Kathy Miller. I'm with the Oregon Public Utility Commission in the Water Utility Section. And I appreciate this opportunity to address the committee regarding House Bill 3971, in particular, the Amendment 3. The PUC has no interest or concern with House Bill 3971. Our concern is with the repeal of the proposed repeal of Amendment ORS 537390. The statute ORS 537390 states that for rate making purposes, no value shall be recognized or allowed for such rights in excess of the actual cost to the owner of perfecting those rights. The Public Utility Commission regulates the service and rates of private investor owned water companies. The Commission is concerned with the repeal of this statute because it may impede the Commission's ability to set reasonable rates and protect customers from unreasonable rates. A water right has an ongoing value. If the statute were repealed, there would be no maximum limit to the value of a water right. Since water is a limited source, demand can outstrip supply, increasing the value of the water right. Hence, customers could forever end up paying for that water right. Essentially, it would be akin to a customer's buying the resource or renting the water right, because this is a continuing cost, and the company would be able to include this in its rates, even though the company has not made any further investment than its initial investment. For PUC rate-making purposes, the Commission might be able to disallow this kind of value because the PUC is based on cost of service and rate of return rate-making. However, if this statute is repealed, this would leave the door wide open to legal challenges, different interpretations on how to deal with the value of the water right in our rate-making process. Currently, the water right is a known and measurable investment. It is a stable situation, and repeal of this statute would make this an uncertainty. I appreciate the comments made by Mr. Glick and Ms. Pagel. We have talked with them prior to this hearing, and we would be willing to work with them to find some way to address both their problems and ours. And I'm here for any questions you might have.
Questions to Ms. Miller? Thank you very kindly.
Thank you.
I have Doug Myers with Water Watch. Good afternoon, Doug.
Afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am Doug Myers, here representing Water Watch. I came here prepared only to talk about Section 3, which is the repeal of the valuation section. My sources told me that would be the sole subject of the bill, of the Dash 3s, and you can see how good a sources I have here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm listening in the back to the people that are testifying in favor of the bill. I am somewhat puzzled as to what the reason for it is. Water Resources has testified there really is no problem. They don't pay any attention to the valuation section anyway. The former director testified to that effect. So what is the problem and what is the evidence that they're presenting to strike this from statute? What is the problem that the bill, that the Dash 3 attempts to solve? Here's a couple of little thoughts, and I'm not attributing these to the proponents of the bill, but something that you might want to think about. If a utility wants to buy water rights in a drought year to increase its hydro or whatever, would this drive up their costs substantially? Are there any Measure 7 implications in the repeal of this? If the state, again, during a year of impending drought, requires conservation measures that would require a water user to reduce his or her consumptive rights by 20-whatever percent, can that affected water right holder claim a Measure 7 taking and demand compensation? What are the fiscal implications of the bill if that were indeed to be so? And with those thoughts, I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Myers. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
Richard Kosenman. You were hoping that I'd forgotten you.
I was hoping, Mr. Chair, that's correct. Thank you. Richard Kosenman with Water for Life. We're fully supportive of about 75% of the bill, sections 1, 2, and 4. And as you have heard, most of the focus on the bill happens to deal with section 3. Basically, it would be our contention that, as a previous witness explained, we have probably a supply and demand problem, and that problem has come to light in recent years. It's only going to get worse. To open up the water law to complete marketing, I think has to be done in a very methodical and slow, well thought out manner. And that's basically the bottom line. To repeal that statute, specifically with one act, I think is a little bit hasty. It should be a long term endeavor. And I'll leave it there.
Questions for Richard?
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Pete Tess with the Oregon Farm Bureau.
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Pete Tess, Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you for the opportunity to comment a little on House Bill 3971, and our testimony is going to sound a little bit like mimicking the last two, but mine comes from my normal paranoia with ag water and the fact that our farmers can't afford to pay as much as cities and other communities can. I have another bill on the Senate side, 710, that hopes to help motivate cities to look elsewhere than agriculture lands and other opportunities to buy their water. And I'm not altogether sure how Section 3 of this bill might affect, if it might motivate or encourage them to buy more ag water or not. Once it's gone, it's going to be gone. So although I don't want to come out strongly against this, and I do support the rest of the bill and support Senate Bill 644, which is basically this bill on the Senate side without Section 3, but have some concerns about 3, and until I'm satisfied that it's not going to motivate wide open water marketing, which I consider to be a disaster for most agriculture producers, I want to be just a little careful and not be encourage such a rash move until we investigate this a little further.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Any questions? Mr. Glick, still no? Do you have any comments you'd like to make to what you've heard? Rebuttals? That's the correct term.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's not a lawyer on the face of the planet that wouldn't like a chance of rebuttal.
I have the misfortune of not having any lawyers on
the committee, so they won't hold your profession against you.
Thank you, sir. The concerns that were raised, well, let me just back up. The concern that was raised by the PUC, Ms. Miller, I think we've already indicated we think we can work with the commission and resolve those concerns. With regard to Mr. Meyer's comment on why are we doing this, what is the problem? The problem is that since the statute has never really been invoked to the point where there are no cases that interpret it, no one quite knows what it means. We are moving into an era where water supplies are scarce, where the pressure to protect flows for in-stream uses for fisheries is getting more and more intense. It just means that we're going to have to be very careful in how we use the water we have and how we allocate the water rights that are already in place, because new ones are going to be hard to get. So what we're concerned about is this language in this bill right now suggests that if two willing parties are interested in exchanging their water rights, if they set a price for that exchange that's based on their own negotiations, not approved by any regulatory body, that price can be held up, and that we won't find at some later date that someone invokes the statute and says, you had no right to pay that value for the water, or to charge that value for the water, because it's limited only to the waterworks. In other words, it puts a cloud over the transactions that we think help to provide water where it is needed at a reasonable cost and at a very low environmental impact. In terms of Mr. Kosasan's comments that we need to be looking at water marketing on a more comprehensive basis, I would just suggest, as Ms. Pagel has, that the ability to trade water has been with us for a very long time. It is something that is commonly done in most of the western states, particularly those that have faced serious competition between water users. It is something that is just part of life today in most places. And in terms of whether this statute, this repeal, would motivate active marketing, as Pete Tess suggests, I don't know the answer to that. I think it would encourage marketing in some places where it makes sense. But please understand that if there were a functioning water market in Oregon, no one would be required to sell and no one would be required to buy. It's not a regulatory program. It's something between willing buyers and sellers. In Lincoln City's case, that's exactly what's happening, is that they are trying to work out an agreement with the water district that Ms. Pagel represents on an arm's length basis in which both parties would benefit. But there is the concern that someday someone will suggest that the deal was unlawful because of this statute and that the price was incorrectly drawn. That's what I would offer by way of rebuttal. We have taken more questions.
Yes, I would suggest at this very moment that the federal government is buying water rights in the Klamath Basin, that they have violated the statute that's on the books, and so I would say the drought transfers that are occurring for both this and the Endangered Species Act concerns will violate the statute most likely, and it's not something that we can keep on the books if we're going to be concerned about those kind of occasions occurring in the future. I'm concerned about that aspect as well as just water marketing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, if that were the case, and if in fact the law were interpreted in that way, that would be a very tragic outcome indeed,
mm-hmm.
because the purpose of those payments that are offered by the Bureau of Reclamation and by some utilities around the region to mitigate for the drought would mean that farmers that were barred from farming this year would receive nothing to help mitigate the loss that they would suffer from a drought year. So we would hope that it doesn't get interpreted that way, but I understand the concern.
Other questions? It's my understanding that there's some willingness for the law firm to negotiate or enter into some discussions with the PUC on some of the difference of opinion and how that might be resolved.
Yes, sir.
Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And I think with that, we'd ask that to take place and that you coordinate that with through Representative Lee's office so that we know what's going on and where we're at with things.
Good. I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. At that point, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3971, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 3002. Yes, would you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3002 comes, was sponsored by us, Committee on Stream Restoration and Species Recovery. Originally, it was asking that it look for a definition of recovery for the purposes of the Oregon Plan. However, we have a dash two amendment, which is replacing the original bill. The dash two amendment is creating a 12-member task force. It is directing the task force to do four things: define recovery for the purposes of salmon recovery, develop and coordinate a scientific workshop with the independent multidisciplinary science team, establish criteria for evaluation of salmon recovery, and develop legislation for recommendation to the 72nd Legislative Assembly. It has a sunset of December 31, 2002, and it has an emergency clause effective upon passage.
And did you read us the information from IMST?
Also, in the background, I did jot down the recommendation that is the foundation that we have used in creating this, the task force, and it is a recommendation number one, where, and I quote, the IMST recommends that the state of Oregon define in measurable terms what is meant by the recovery of depressed stocks of salmonids. The footnote or the explanation to that recommendation is, quote, continued, without a measurable definition, there is no technical basis on which progress towards accomplishing the mission of the Oregon Plan can be assessed. This severely limits the application of the principles of adaptive management and the prioritization of recovery and research initiatives. Criteria for recovery need to incorporate demographic and genetic factors. A scientific workshop may be helpful in developing these criteria. End of quote.
Okay. The committee will recall that that this was a bill that we brought before you earlier in the session, and that there was some grave consternation on the part of the Department of Fish and Wildlife and others about even the suggestion of something as far-reaching as identifying what recovery might be. The chair, of course, was delighted to find that the IMST was in somewhat agreement with him as to the value of defining recovery, not suggesting that the original bill that was before you had or was the silver bullet for recovery, but was there for the purposes of introducing discussion and conversation on this topic.
recognizing that this is a work session, and we have invited testimony only during work session, we would accept testimony from anyone in the audience today, if you can keep it very short, on this particular topic. And I do have representative, former state representative Terry Thompson from Newport, who has asked to testify on this bill. Terry.
Thank you. I am former state representative Terry Thompson, and representing only myself on this issue, and my not coming through. Okay. And only from my experience as a commercial fisherman, salmon fisherman for 20 some years, when I picked up the Dash 2 amendments and looked down the list of people that were to sit on this group, which I think it's a fine thing to go ahead and move forward and just have the discussion about what recovery should be. But I noticed when I got down to H, it says representative of the angling and fishing community is one person. Now, I don't know of anybody who can sit in this position and represent the sports and commercial fisheries in itself. And I think that both entities should be listed there, because if you'll remember right, in this whole process, it's been basically the commercial fishermen for years who fought for salmon recovery, partly for their own industry utilization, and for with sportsmen. And to only have one person set in that position, I think would be a challenge for that person that couldn't be accomplished. So I think that one of those seats in the Dash 2 amendments should be a commercial fisherman, and one of them should be a sports fisherman. Since a lot of the salmon recovery things that have happened came from funds that were developed by the federal government, to my knowledge, that were sent down to help the commercial fishing and sports fishing industries. So I think that we need to do that. I do think we should move forward and try to define recovery and say, well, it's a federal government program. This is what I hear. It needs to be done at the federal level. In my experience of dealing with the federal government for years in fisheries, it usually takes those of us in the state of Oregon to give them the written words, and then they will mess around with it and come up with their own definition. But it's usually pretty close to what we decide in the state of Oregon when it comes to fisheries legislation. So I agree with the IMST. We need to get on with this.
Questions of Mr. Thompson? Thank you, Terry.
Chair Jensen, member of the committee. My name is Ken Evans, representing the Fisheries Restoration Enhancement Coalition. Having only had a chance to look at this in the last few minutes, without talking to the group, I'd like to point out that I believe we're going to be in agreement with what is going on here. I haven't had a chance, obviously, to talk to anybody specifically, but we like the intent of where this is going. It's been our contention all along that the Oregon plan is really primarily focused on water quality and land use, and to have a task force that jointly looks at this issue in regards to the Oregon plan and implementing the Oregon plan, specifically as this bill is mentioning recovery of salmon recovery, is I think a good thing. I would like to agree at this point in time with what Terry Thompson was saying. I think that this issue, recovery, the Oregon plan, is something that the sport and commercial fishing industries have been working on for, 7,500 years. And to have just one person, which probably, like Terry indicated, couldn't find anybody that specifically would represent commercial and sport at the same time. So having multiple members, I think, is would be apropos, or I think we would suggest to this body. So with that, I'd like to conclude my testimony.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative King.
Well, I thought that one position that we were talking about, item H, that one representative, I thought that they had in mind Terry for that, except they didn't put angling and fishing community and former representative.
Representative King, Chair, members of the committee, I'm sure Terry Thompson would be an excellent candidate for that position, and I'm sure there's many others. You might reflect the three public members, one maybe pulling one of them from there,
Mr. Evans, having served on committees with former Representative Thompson in the past, the problem that would bother me about having him on the committee is he really doesn't have any opinions about that.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to have to disagree with the chair on that one. I'm sorry. I try not to make a practice of doing that. So.
Okay, thanks, Ken.
Thank you.
Willie Kiffney, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for calling me up. I just briefly had a chance to look at the Dash 2 amendments. Again, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities. And there are six state agency representatives or state interest representatives on the committee, but no local government representatives on this task force determining the definition of recovery. We believe that it is important to have a local government perspective as many municipalities are developing recovery programs and trying to comply with other recovery standards as well. And so there would be some concern about conflicting definitions of recovery, and want to bring that kind of consistent perspective to this task force, and I think it can be helpful in doing that. I apologize for coming late on this bill, and be happy to work on the Senate side, Mr. Chair, if you're willing to move this bill, or work on amendments.
Mr. Tiffany, it is the intention of the chair in this bill, as in all bills coming out of this committee, that they basically be clean and not necessarily in need of work on the Senate side. So we're not looking to work bills on the Senate side. We're interested in, and the reason we've invited some testimony from the people this afternoon is to get precisely the information that we're getting so that we can proceed with it. But we wanted to avoid at this late hour, since we've already had testimony, a large public hearing section on it. We thank you for that.
Appreciate that, Mr.
And we do, your point is well taken, although the chair is crushed that the League of Oregon Cities would not think that the members of the House of Representatives are not very sensitive to the concern of the League of Oregon Cities.
I'm sorry I implied that, Mr.
Hey. Yes.
Maybe we can get Terry Thompson running for city council.
Take care of our interests.
Thank you, Willie.
Thank you.
Yes, at this point, we would also like to have staff provide you with a follow-up statement. And it has to do with a draft report, 1 September 2000, from the National Marine Fishery Service, which we'll hand out a document in a moment to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, also, before the hearing, the governor's office did contact me, and they just had a quick minute to review the bill. They liked the way it looks, and they also made the suggestion that in Section 1, where it is speaking to where the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House do the appointing of the task force, that the governor's office be included in that also. And that's it.
Thank you for the opportunity to comment, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Roy Elliker, legislative coordinator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And as Sandy just reiterated, in the governor's office, there's nobody there that can give some immediate comment on this. From the department standpoint, we defer to the governor's officer. So I understand that these amendments do address some of the concerns brought up by the state agencies that I've heard before. There is some question, I think, from the governor's office as to the IMST reference, as to exactly the scientific workshop aspect. I'm thinking that we might see maybe a stronger relationship with the IMST. And I know the other issue was there the joint appointment power. From my notes here, I think the governor's office wants to be involved in that as well. From the department aspects, again, sir, if the governor's office is in agreement, we certainly are. on the task force aspects of this.
Well, I think we're kicking to another bill we have. At this point, the chair would like to appoint a work group to look at the issues that have been discussed. Membership on that work group will include the people who have volunteered to testify this afternoon.
You stepped in the door.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I have a question to Mr. Elliker. Mr. Elliker, are there any additional groups that you find might possibly benefit for having a member on this task force? Or the task force might benefit from having a member be represented?
Well, Chair Jensen, Representative Worth, I know that the costs of rebuilding salmon runs, a lot of them do fall on local governments. And perhaps a local government representative might be a good idea. But I think that's something that in the work group we'll discuss. Other than that, off the top of my head, I can't think of any other situation. But in the work group situation, I'm sure this will be some discussion.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Well, Representative Knope here kind of, summarizes my suggestions, and possibly he says, quote, Greenpeace, maybe, is lacking from being mentioned as a member on this task force.
And they will represent Mr. Knope's interest.
Right. Maybe I'm not that far from that, but possibly that is along the route I guess I was thinking.
This is obviously Friday afternoon.
Thank you. Fringe.
The committee and for people's information, the composition of this was amendment was drawn quite quickly and without a lot of thought that we need to have about it. It was done so because of it is the feeling of the chair that this may be one of the most important things that we can do this session in this committee. And time is of the essence. So simply in order to get something to legislative council, to get something back, we very quickly drafted the dash two amendments. Now, composition of membership on that, there are several things that I do see that, and recognize very, very valid points with. However, one of my experiences, limited though it is in this body, is that the larger the size of the committee, the more dysfunctional it becomes. I think if you have a committee of two, it's relatively functional, and its dysfunctional rate increases at a geometric rate for every person you add to it. So it was the chair's intention to try to keep the committee small enough that we might be able to actually have a real working group. To cover all of the people needed in doing that will certainly be difficult. We did leave the three at-large things, realizing we may not have three at-large, but they may all be specified members. But we'll be happy to entertain discussion on that. It comes as a great surprise to the chair that the governor's office would have taken any exception to not being included as an appointing part of the appointing member, and again, somewhat shocked that the confidence is not there in the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate that they would do these things objectively for the best interests of the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Had you been a member of the Republican Party longer than you are, I'm sure that confidence would be there.
Thank you, Representative.
Nice shot.
I'm
just sure the governor was offering to help, and
I'm sure he was. We were merely looking at the very difficult workload that the governor's office has. We've heard testimony from the governor's office that appointments are one of the most difficult things they have. They search long and hard to find appointments. And so we were just trying to make life a little easier.
Mr. Chair, I'd also say that if we want to do a quid pro quo thing, if the governor has some more groups that I would like to help him appoint members to.
Oh, okay.
I revert back to my previous comment.
We're going to, at this point, having done all the damage we can to House Bill 3002 for today, close the work session on 3002. And we are going to open a work session on House Bill 3124. And the chair would like to have a motion to, so there's a price tag on that particular bill. And when Sandy reviews the bill for us, the chair would entertain a motion to refer to Ways and Means without recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3124 to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation.
Representative Leonard moves House Bill 3124 to the Committee on Ways and Means without recommendation. Would you review the bill momentarily for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3124 is at the request of Representative Devlin. It is establishing a program to examine the health risks from contaminated fish in the waters of the state of Oregon. It's appropriating monies from the general fund to implement such programs. And the specified amount in the bill is $293. $293,000.
It is.
No chocolate for
anyone. Representative Westland will be very proud of this committee to know that we're going to refer to Ways and Means a price tag of $293. Thank you. Thank you.
$293.717.
Right.
We have heard the motion. Is there a discussion? Hearing none, clerk will call the roll.
No.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Chair votes not.
All right, we will close the work session on House Bill 3124.
Did it pass?
You need to not. Not
yes, it passed.
House Bill 3124 is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with no recommendation.
We'll make a little further discussion.
We need to do that. Mm-hmm. Open a work session on House Bill 3016. We have invited testimony of Mr. Roy Ellicott.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3016 is directing the Department of Fish and Wildlife to use Ratonin to eliminate the Cooey Chub population of Diamond Lake. We heard this bill last week. We have asked the department to come back and provide us with some information that addresses some questions of some realistic options relating to other types of fish in the lake and some dollar amounts associated with the program.
Thank you, sir. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, Roy Ellicott, Legislative Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. On my right, Mr. Dave Loomis, District Biologist for Southwest Region and probably the person in the department most familiar on the ground with the aspects of Diamond Lake and its fisheries.
And a darn good guy, too.
Darn good guy, too. Thank you, Mr. Bruce. I agree with that. Representative Jensen, we prepared perhaps, I hope not too long, an attachment here for the review of the committee, but I think there's a couple sections that go right to the heart, sir, of your questions of the last hearing on this bill. let me just give you a kind of a brief overview here on the statement. It's got an overview again, which you I think you've seen before about Diamond Lake, and its history is that one of the great trout fisheries, actually Southwest Oregon. And we have some estimated costs of the bill, which I'll get to in a second. Got estimated total cost by strategy, whether that's throat known or the non-treatment strategy. And we have a section on restoration potential. Then we go more fully into the strategies. And number three, starting on page three, really lays out the complete throat known treatment alternative, including the Federal National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, process. Page four really is in some ways the heart of some of the issues on the environmental impact statement now, about halfway or a little bit more being completed. There's some fairly difficult and complex water quality issues that need to be worked through as part of the EIS, and we detail those on page four. Then we lay out more in detail our process costs. And then starting at the bottom page five and all of page six, sir, we have laid out very detailed species, possible species and brood stock considered under the experimental fish stocking program. Frankly, rainbow trout, brown trout, possibly spring chinook from the North Umpqua drainage. And then we have lastly finish up interim management starting on page seven. And let me perhaps go to the heart of the question asked by the committee last time, which was essentially the cost of House Bill 3016, and I'd refer you to page 2. In an analysis of cost, looking at Bill 3016, which again calls for, and there's another issue here I talked about in terms of the date, but it calls for July 1st, 2003. Use of rote known, taking steps to screen off streams, prevent downstream contamination while rote known is being applied, removing the fish poisons, and then restocking with rainbow trout. And essentially, if you look at page two of our handout today, if we look at what we can consider the estimated cost of House Bill 3016 in the 01-03 biennium, completion of the environmental impact statement, we estimate about $180,000. That's for a full completion and going to a record of decision by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. And then that's the second part, maintenance of fish stocking, about $100,000 a year for that, total $380,000 for next biennium. Then if there was any experimental fish stocking, that was the department or committee or first of all, the commission would have to direct the department to move into that, but certainly we work closely with legislators on that issue. But if there was any experimental fish stocking that we'd like to try and move into next biennium, we figure that would be an additional $200,000. So total cost with the startup of experimental fish stocking for next biennium, approximately $580,000. Now, if we look at by strategy, what kind of looking ahead in a broader view, the estimated total cost by the strategy. If we look at the rote known treatment, again, we see the completion of the EIS, $180,000. Then we see the actual price of the rote known treatment and the drawdown of the lake, at this point, probably $3.5 million. That may, in fact, go up because we're out from rote knowning several years, and the cost of rote knowning over the last few years have been really going up. It's a very difficult chemical to obtain. I'll let Dave go into details, but you know, you have to get essentially from South America. Very severe process to get the chemical, and costs have just been going up and up for treatment of rote known over the last, say, 10 years or more. And the earliest we think that we'd really be able to use rote known, if the EIS allowed us to, would be sometime in 2004. So one of the issues with the bill, Mr. Chair, on House Bill 3016 is that the House bill does direct the department by July 1, 2003, even the most optimistic of schedules the department can envision, the department would not probably be using rote known by that date, probably be after 2003 that we'd actually get to apply the rote known. Finishing up then, if we looking through the estimated total cost by strategy, fish stocking, if we could go back to the fish stocking procedures of previous decades. With the elimination of the TUI chub, we're looking at about $25,000 per year, which we'd start again with fingerling stocking probably in 2005 and then every year thereafter to get back into the fishery we had once there in the 60s and 70s. And then for non-treatment experimental fish stocking alternative, the experimental fish stocking, $440,000 per year. That also includes pretty extensive monitoring to be able to see whether or not what's happening with these experimental stocks. Are they actively controlling chub? Are they actively feeding on chub? Again, I'll let Mr. Loomis give you details on that. And the maintenance fish stocking, which we currently have there now ongoing, again, that would continue at about $100,000 a year, and that's for stocking fairly large-sized rainbows right now. That concludes my prepared testimony, but certainly here, welcome any questions from the committee.
One thing, excuse me, the one thing that I don't have is how much money are we going to spend on the existing methodology over the next decade? And I mean, are we giving up on this as a fishery? Are we just going to, you know, look at it in a, you know, a partial sort of thing? From everything that I'm hearing and have heard, the chances of eliminating the chewy chub in there by any other means are relatively small, and I haven't heard you give me any kind of, you know, prediction on how much that might be, what kind of probability we have that we can do this some other way. So as we do these kind of, you know, kind of piecemeal sort of things, are we ever going to get anywhere, and how much is it going to cost us to get there? And I recognize that if we do the road known, that it's likely to be a heavier upfront load. I at least am willing to accept the concept or idea of that. Whether we can ever get the money is another question, but I'm willing to accept the concept or the idea of that. But if we do, then if we're taking the second assumption, we do use the road known. Are we going to be able to clean out the chewy chub and, in fact, reestablish a viable trout fishery and prevent the rope known from coming back, or prevent the chewy chub from coming back?
Chair,
there's about six questions there.
Chair Jensen, let me try some of them, and I'll turn some over to Dave here. The reason why you have not heard about other strategies to completely remove the tuy chub from Diamond Lake, sir, is that the department is really not aware. We have been looking and trying to figure out if there are other ways to completely remove the tuy chub from Diamond Lake. The answer is that we have found none. If we are unable to use the rote known treatment, okay, then we are forced to just try and develop some kind of fishery at the lake. But there's no strategy we have found.
At some infinite cost.
Right. There's no strategy we know of to remove that to each other.
Okay.
You got to kill them.
What?
You got to kill them, that's it.
Well, yeah, no, that's what I'm asking. Before we get into the discussion of what we're going to do, I need to be clear of what the options are that we have. Now, we can make the choice that, okay, we'll never restore the trout fishery there. And we can have a big chewy chub fishery, I guess. That's a choice. I don't want to look at some of these things as, you know, some sort of pie in the sky that somewhere we've got possibility if we do some other thing.
No.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to be out of, and I'm sorry, we are out of time, and... we have another committee that's going to want in here to do some quick tap work, and if we don't get out of the room, I'm going to have not only members of my committee unhappy with us, but members of that other committee unhappy with me. And I certainly wouldn't want the chair of that other committee unhappy with me since I sit on that committee. So we will, at this point, thank you very much, and we will have to, I think, come back here, Representative King. And I do appreciate your bringing this bill forward. I think there's some real, I think we need to, you know, make a decision. What do we want to do with Diamondback? And then start to work accordingly, you know, for that. Thank you very much. We close the work session on House Bill 3016, and if there's no other items there for the committee that are necessary, we are going to adjourn.